up in the bad book? Were they the shaman that didn't make it?
Well, this is a big, that's a good question. You know, that's a really big question. What has happened? What happened with those souls? You know, and there's different answers. Jewish mysticism has a lot of different answers. This is whereas the idea of purgation, you know, comes in Gehenna and that sort of thing. And it's just, it's a complicated issue. But we know from the apostles that there are certainly those who will be resurrected. Everybody gets resurrected in the end. And that resurrection happens when the spirit is returned to the body and the body is brought back alive. We know from the apostles that these there will be a final judgment where not everybody comes out, you know, in a good place, right? Yeah. But yes, the answer is yes. Those are souls that didn't make it. Yep.
Mm-hmm. The goats.
Yeah.
But just to recap, am I correct in understanding that basically everyone is predestined to become or to accept the mission or to become like Christ? I mean, that's like,
no, I don't think so.
Purpose?
Yeah, it's
everyone is foreknown and predestined.
I think maybe you could read it that way. Maybe you could read it that way. But this idea of being foreknown seems to me to imply that this is a deal that was worked out before. Maybe not everybody was foreknown in that particular. I mean, everybody must have been foreknown in one way or another. But
well, intended with the purpose or the intention of becoming righteous and redeemed.
Yeah, you got me there. Yep. But my understanding on it is I'm reading it as like, for example, when Jeremiah is you know, you knew me before. I mean, he's known in a specific way. To know someone, oh, here's a passage for you. Paul pulls in some other mysticism when he says that in the world to come, we will know him. We'll know God even as we are fully known. You know, so this idea implies this foreknowing is like an individual relationship of the soul to Hashem. And so I don't know what it means in terms of, are there people who are not foreknown? No. Everybody's foreknown in one way or another. So I guess maybe it comes all the way back around to like, well, now you're just predestining people to damnation. I don't think so. Probably, if we're to understand, and I'm just speculating just off the top of my head, you know, this is all mysticism. God knows how he runs his universe and we don't. But from what we know of God, every human soul is given this destiny. Right?
So if the purpose is to redeem the whole world, then it's not unreasonable to believe it. Everyone sets out with the same destiny to be redeemed ultimately. Whether they make it or not, I don't know.
Right. Whether they make it or not is the question.
But maybe not in the same way. So maybe their end result is predestined, but how they get there.
And that's kind of the point I was trying to drive at. It was that Jeremiah had a unique mission. He was foreknown for a unique mission. He was given a unique destiny. I believe every soul has its own unique mission to fulfill. And so this is why, you know, it's convenient for us to be able to put people in categories and judge people in categories. And it's always been convenient in Christendom to assign people to the category of the damned and the saved, you know, because what you want to do then is shuffle as many people from the damned category over to the saved category. And ordinarily, the way to do that is to get them to consent to a certain set of dogmas or ceremonies, which are called, what do you call that?
Sacraments,
yeah. Sacraments. But those are really our constructions around trying to understand what God is doing with human beings.
So your thinking is that, like in a Mission Impossible show, they're given the souls are given a mission to bring
yes.
the world to God.
Yeah.
And then they're born, so you can say that they had the mission before they were born into this world.
Correct.
So they're in the other world, so the predestiny is you're given the mission before you get here.
Correct. That's how I understand it.
And then their choice here on this planet is whether or not they accept it.
Yes. This is how I understand it, yes. They've already accepted the mission.
Okay.
Yeah.
Whether or not they stick to, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. We'll come back to this. We'll come back to this whole discussion and argument, and we'll rack our brains over it some more when we get further on in Romans, because then we're going to be dealing pretty soon with Jacob and Esau, and Jacob I loved and Esau I hated, and the two were, one was wicked from the womb, and we're going to be worried about Pharaoh and God hardening his heart and that sort of thing. So we have plenty of time to figure out later, right? Right. Right. Okay.
Perspective in Galatians.
Yes.
He's talking about, but when God, who had set me apart from my mother's womb.
Right.
That part. I only knew it because I saw it in the notes.
No, you're right. You're right.
But it's just interesting because it says, but when, it's in Galatians 1, verse 15. But when God, who had set me apart even in my from my mother's womb and called me through his grace, was pleased to reveal his son to me so that I might reach him among the Gentiles. And it continues on. He's
yeah.
kind of giving his authority on
mm-hmm.
why he's
doing. Yeah, and as he goes on in that passage, he'll go on to explain that he was given this assignment of taking the gospel to the Gentiles and
yeah.
and this revelation that came to him. So, yeah, that was Paul's destiny.
Yeah.
Good. All right, so we're on verse 30, right? So those whom he predestined for the mission of being conformed to the image of his son, he also called. And those he called, he also justified. That's what we were working on. That is, exonerated in the final judgment. And those whom he justified, those who he exonerated in the final judgment, by writing their names in the book of life, okay, he also glorified. What does that mean? It means in the resurrection of the dead. To be glorified in this context refers to being raised from the dead. We're not glorified yet. I know he's using the past tense forms, but we're also not, in the final judgment yet. So we don't get it. It's Paul's dealing with eternal things. So he can use the past tense. It's already happened. It just hasn't happened yet. Make sense? It's timey-wimey. All right. Going on. What then shall we say to these things? And what do I tell you every time Paul says, what then shall we say? The next statement is going to be a false premise, right? But he didn't put in a false premise this time. So I put one in for him. I put one in for him because he actually has been working this thing the whole chapter. And the false premise he began with, I mean, he's been, it's the premise that he began the chapter with when he said, there is therefore no condemnation for those who are in the Messiah Yeshua. So he's finally come up in the point in his argument where he's referring back to that statement. And he says, what then shall we say to these things? That, and here's the part I'm supplying for him, that there is condemnation for those in Messiah Yeshua? By no means. It can't be. That, because if God is for us, who can be against us? And how do we know God is for us? Because he didn't spare his own son, but gave him up for us all. How will he not also, with him, graciously give us all things? including the resurrection and the exoneration and the final judgment, including the, you know, the that we've been foreknown, called, predestined, and so forth to be conformed into the image of His Son. Does that make sense to you? I mean, it's okay. He can. He's working this argument. Who shall bring any charge against God's elect? I just put a note in here for you. I didn't mean for this to actually be part of the interpolation. I just noted that when he says God's elect, this is a term which ordinarily applies exclusively to Israel. When it says the elect or God's elect, in a Jewish context, that's the same as saying the chosen. And if I say the chosen people, you know who I'm talking about. So when you read the elect, your mind should first go to that place. You know, just like when Yeshua says, he says that the angels are going to come with a great shofar blast and gather the elect from the four corners. Well, this is saying nothing new. This is the same thing the prophets said, that a shofar would blow and God's going to gather the exiles of Israel from the four corners of the earth and gather them into the... That's the elect, the chosen. Okay, so Paul's using this. He says, who shall bring any charges against God's elect? He's using this in a different way. You could almost accuse him of replacement theology at this point, of saying, you're replacing the definition of being the chosen people here. You're replacing it with those in the book of life, with those who have been foreknown, called, predestined, and justified. Now, I'm not really accusing Paul of replacement theology or anything like that. But even Paul realizes what he's doing is a little risky, because you know what's going to happen when we start up again in chapter 9. He's going to go into discussing the relationship with Israel. And what about Israel who doesn't believe? He's going to start working with this. We don't have to worry about that for a long time. That'll be after the holidays. Anyway, so he says, who shall bring any charge against God's elect? It's God who justifies. God's the one who writes your names in the book of life. I mean, what are you going to do? Who's going to, if your name is written in the book of life, who's going to, you know, in the courtroom, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the accuser is there. Satan is there. He's the prosecuting attorney. He's the one bringing the charges. You did sins. You did a lot of sins. You did way more sins than you even remember. I have a whole list. I've got the book here. It's all written down. All your deeds are written in a book. He has all... But if your name is already written in the book of life, it's case closed. There's no trial. The prosecutor has nothing to say. So he says... it's God who justifies. He's the one who exonerates. Who is to condemn? So you see, he's throwing out these rhetorical questions. These are answers to that missing false premise. And that's why I feel quite confident in supplying the missing false premise for him. So who is to condemn? Christ Jesus is the one who died. More than that, who was raised, who is at the right hand of God, who is indeed interceding for us. And so what the missing information that I'm supplying for you here is when he says this, it's you have to understand what he says, the Messiah, Yeshua, is in the position of authority to judge. He is the one who is going to be doing the judging in the final judgment. And this is based on that passage from Daniel where it says, I saw it. Thrones were put in place, the thrones of judgment, and one like a son of man coming. And then in the book of Enoch, this is explained in more detail, that the son of man, who is the Messiah, sits on the seat of judgment in the final judgment. And so here's Paul's point. Who is there to condemn when the Messiah, Yeshua, is in the position of the authority to make the judgment? And he is the one who died more in order to exonerate you. And so he's not going to condemn you if he died for you in order to exonerate you. And more than that, who was raised, he's at the right hand of God and is indeed interceding for us. In other words, he's on your side. So who shall separate us from the love of the Messiah, from the love of Christ? Now, I'm going to supply for him the false premise indicator. I think he should throw in a, what then shall we say at this point? What then shall we say? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword separate us? As it is written in Psalm 22:22, for your sake we are being killed all day long. We are regarded as sheep to be slaughtered. And then he answers his false premise. No, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. All right, I want to give you a few comments on this passage. It's pretty neat. When he rolls these off, shall tribulation, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, danger, sword. These are all ways that you can die unpleasant deaths. All right? I think he has Rosh Hashanah themes going on in his mind here. On Rosh Hashanah, there's a particular prayer that we say called, let us now relate the awesomeness of this day, in which we rattle off a list like this, a list of terrible things that it's like, on this day, on Rosh Hashanah, it's decided, and on Yom Kippur, it's sealed. Who will die and who will live? Who will die? Well, Troy can tell us. Troy, tell us what the list is. No, okay. Yeah, he only knows. Hunger, famine. Yeah, hunger, famine, thirst. By the sword, by fire, by drowning, by
water.
Yeah, by pretty much every way that you can think of dying, is listed in this prayer. And this sounds very much like Paul's talking about judgment. He's talking these judgment themes, these high holiday themes. And he says, shall any of these things, shall tribulation, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, danger, sword, all these things that will kill us in the body, physically kill us, shall any of these separate us from the love of Messiah? And he gives us a proof text, as it's written, for your sake we are being killed all the day. We are regarded as sheep to be slaughtered. This is what the believers are enduring. The proof text is kind of a sad text from Psalm 22. If you know the psalm, this is where the psalmist is saying, you know, God, if we were apostate, if the nation was apostate and we were worshiping idols and everything, I could understand you're not being with us. But we've been pretty good. You know, we've been really faithful to your covenant. We've kept all your commandments, and we're still experiencing, we're being put to death. We're being killed all day long, regarded as sheep to be slaughtered. So Paul cites this passage, I think, because it applies to the first century community that is suffering tribulation, distress, persecution, hunger, poverty, danger, and the Roman sword, and suffering these things. He says, is any of these things, any physical death at all, any physical suffering, we're talking about the suffering of the body, is any of that going to separate us? No. In all these things, we are more than conquerors. And this conquerors, I think, he's got the arena in mind, a Roman arena, where you've got gladiators, you know, fighting wild beasts, or gladiators fighting other gladiators. And these various things that are assaulting us, these physical maladies that are assaulting us, these woes and trials and tribulations, they can't win. In all these things we're more than conquerors, we're the victors in the arena through him who loved us. For I am sure that neither death, book of death, nor life, book of life, nor angels, those are the good guys, nor rulers, those are the bad guys, nor things present in this current age, nor things to come in the kingdom and in the world to come, nor spiritual powers, nor height of heaven above, nor depth of Sheol below, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in the Messiah, in Christ Jesus, our Master. Okay. We'll see you in a month or two.